Welcome to the Fly Culture Podcast, bringing you interviews, reviews, and fishing tips. Here's your host, Pete Tigus.
Welcome everyone to the very latest Fly Culture podcast. This is being recorded in early April. I hope everyone is keeping safe. I hope everyone is keeping well. I'm really excited to be speaking to a good friend of mine, Stan Mankoff. He's over in Bulgaria, and we're going to learn today a little bit about the fishing in that area and also in the Balkan area and some of the exploits he's been up to. And he does a lot. He's a pretty hardcore angler, really good guy, and we're going to learn a little bit about his fishing, a little bit about his life, and hopefully pick up some fishing tips from him as well. So Stan, it's really good to have you here.
Hello Peter. First of all, I want to thank you for inviting me to take a part in this podcast. I'm really flattered because I've been listening to it and I've seen all the big fishing legends talking on, like Charles Jardine, Peter McLeod, Peter Coquille. They're legends for me, and it's my turn now. So I'm really happy about it, excited.
You're a legend to me, Stan, as well. And, you know, I follow your exploits and, you know, thank you for your support as well. And I know we've known each other quite a long time. I haven't seen you for a little bit, but I remember you writing for us for the online magazine we had, Eat Sleep Fish, which gave us a little hint of the sort of fishing that you get up to. And then I think the last time we bumped into each other, we belonged to the same casting instructors association, and we were sitting on a first aid course. And I think the last time I saw you, I had you bandaged up.
That's it. It was a while ago. Yeah, it was quite long ago, but thing hasn't changed that much. So I used to live in the UK before, as you know, but then I moved here in Bulgaria now for the last, what is it now, 7-8 years. Time flies.
And everything's going okay there. And I guess you guys are under lockdown and you're all keeping safe and well there.
We are in the lockdown officially since the Friday 13th of March. And things are going a bit slower here, but I hope it's for good.
And are you tying flies like mad?
Especially the first few days, I put some order on my desk. It took 3 days to put the materials. I did a time lapse on this. It's some serious work. I never thought I'd be able to do it, but it's all in its place now. I found it harder to work when everything has its certain place. I want it all on the desk.
And that's the key, isn't it, to production tying, is getting everything lined up and ready so that you go from one fly to the next one, I guess.
Exactly. But I also like to tie different flies, especially when I tie for myself, which is the most fun.
Everything. Fantastic. What I'd love to do is, well, let's get a sense of, you know, with the lockdown, obviously we're all talking about that at the moment, but have you been able to get out and go fish and catch some trout?
Oh, yeah. Season starts really, really early here on the 1st of February. I think it's a bit too early, but they won't change it because of me. So it's quite cold. It's still winter time. But we have the choke stream. We have a few tailwaters, and fish are active on those places. So I've been fishing. Even guided a few days. English friend of mine who stuck here is married for a Bulgarian woman, and we've been fishing together, and we caught some nice fish, brown trout.
Have the fish been rising? Do they rise early on in the season, or are you sort of having to get down deep and dirty?
On that choke stream, they do rise. It's really, actually, it's pretty good time of the year for some small olive dry fly fishing. And they are rising usually in midday now. I think at this time of the year, fishing is at its best in the middle of the day, let's say from 11 to about 2 o'clock. That's when the fish become active. And it's not a huge, massive hatch, but on a cloudy day, it's decent. And then I just like to fish the dry fly. Well, the rest of the time, we fish dry fly as a dropper, as an indicator. And that's also very effective with a tiny small nymph below.
Fantastic. It's the best way of searching the water, really, isn't it?
It is, really.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do, Stan, is get a sense of the fishing over there. And as you said, that you've lived in the UK. So to get some sort of comparisons, and like I said at the very beginning, that, you know, you're based in Bulgaria, but you really do travel. But what I'd like to start with is getting a sense of the fishing there, the sort of fishing, how close you are to fishing. Do you need to have to travel? And then perhaps follow that up afterwards, a little bit about the culture over there, how fly fishing, is there a big fly fishing community there? Are there a lot of people doing it? So perhaps if you can give us a little sense of how that's sitting right now.
Okay, sure. So I'll probably start from how I started fishing in general. I'm born and I grew up in Sofia, but I was very lucky that my parents are not from Sofia, and they live in different parts of Bulgaria, which I consider are to be the best fishing parts, more or less. So I grew up and spent a lot of time in the summer vacation, summer holidays, in a small town in central Bulgaria, in central Balkan mountain. So it's a beautiful place, and it's plenty of small rivers in the area. And it's Balkan mountain is a huge mountain range that gives the name of the Balkan Peninsula and all those Balkan countries. And it's most of it is situated in Bulgaria. And there is a lot of small mountain freestone rivers and streams. And that's where I started fishing. My granddad taught me fishing with pole for trout. It was trout fishing I started with. And I just loved it ever after. And my mother is from another area, which is where the more alpine mountains of Bulgaria are. It's the Pirin and the Rila mountain. And there is also some bigger rivers are there, and also the high mountain lakes are there. So we were hiking up in the mountain with my parents, and I was fishing those lakes when I was a kid. So it was just the perfect surrounding to know the river and to spend as much time as possible outside on the river, observing nature and wildlife. And I think then I was a fisherman, and when I was about 14, I started doing fly fishing. I got interested from the internet, from some magazines, and it's been fly fishing ever after. And yeah, then I moved to UK on a later stage of my life to study biology, but also to study more about fly fishing, because yeah, it's a lot to be learned there. And interesting fact about Bulgaria is that they say the first written evidences for fly fishing says that it started somewhere in this area. It says Macedonia, but it's been a region then. And it says the river, which we don't know exactly its name now, is a river. There's people that fish for those fish imitating flies. The river was situated between Beroe, which is now a town in Bulgaria with different name, Stara Zagora, and Thessalonica, which is a town in Greece. So it's basically where spent most of my time fishing, between those two towns. And there is still some fish to be caught. There's still some fish to be caught here, mainly brown trout. We don't have grayling. So when I first met the grayling. It was exciting for me, and I really like to fish for grayling. First in, it's very strange. We don't have it in Bulgaria, but in Serbia, which is a few hundred kilometers, this is our neighbor country, they have it. So we start fishing for grayling there, and then the other Balkan countries have the grayling too. It's just that we in Bulgaria and Greece, northern Macedonia, there's no grayling in this part.
Do you know if there's any reason for that, Stan? Is it water quality, or is it they've just never made it that way, or what do you think
it might be? I think it's just they never made it that far. There are no evidences that grayling has been in Bulgaria. They introduced it during communist time some 40 years ago. I don't know why. They put it in lakes and it doesn't survive for too long. There was some point some 40 years ago that there was grayling, but not anymore. The last caught grayling in Bulgaria I've heard of is caught in 2002 by a friend of mine. And then I haven't heard of grayling anymore.
Right, right.
Trout is fun.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit more about that then, because it's interesting that you talked about tailwaters, so I guess, you know, dams. And you also mentioned the word chalk stream, which obviously will make mine and a lot of other people's ears prick up. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about those sorts of streams and how you fish those and some advice there, really.
Yeah. Well, we only have a few chalk stream. One is closer to Sofia, about an hour away, but it's much smaller. The other one I was visiting with Paul was the bigger one. It's called Zlatna Panega, which stands for Golden Panega. I don't know, Panega is just a name. And it's a beautiful river, really beautiful river that's coming out of a cave. There is a cave, and the water is springs out of the cave. And it's not gin clear like the UK chalk streams, but it's a proper chalk stream, and it has all the weeds. It has plenty of well-fed brown trout there, a lot of insect life. And it's really nice chalk stream. It's not. It's plenty of trees around. It's not that open. It's not easy to fish to cast everywhere. But it's a school, a casting school, I would say. Once you learn to fish there, you can do almost anywhere else.
And I guess that's where a great fishing guide comes useful as well.
Definitely, because you have to know from where to approach exactly if you want to catch that fish. And this chalk stream is not that easy always to just go out there and catch a few fish. Sometimes it can be challenging, but if you are there on the right time, it can be great fishing. It can be just great. And right time is when it's cloudy and when it's raining, perhaps. It's very important on this chalk stream to go when there's clouds and it's not bright sun.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And you say the hatches are good. Is there big lush weed growth as well to support insect?
There is plenty of weed. The problem now here in Bulgaria and probably all the Balkan countries, I don't want to talk about problems too much now. Don't want to stress on this, but it's the dams and the mini dams. They're building, and they built the last few years. And this happens here as well. Plenty of rivers, they build those mini dams, which is pointless. And then they don't make a proper fish pass there for the fish to pass. And that's the biggest problem. But this is happening everywhere. We try to fight against this, but we won some fights. We stopped quite a few of them. But on other places, they still build them. They build them in Slovenia. They build them in Bosnia on some of the best rivers. And I don't mind probably too much those big dams, because maybe there is need for them to be built. But those micro hydropower stations, these are not definitely not of any use.
And it's interesting you say about you fight these dams and you've won some cases. Yeah. And something very close to my heart has been sewage treatment works over here and fighting against those. What sort of process did you go through to try and stop those dams, and certainly in the ones that worked? What sort of things were you doing to make the government listen?
Okay. There is this fishing club here. They really did a lot of work against those dams. So they're just organizing. We organized because I'm helping them as well. As I'm not part of their club, but I'm trying to help as much as possible. So we are organizing protests, and they're writing, what is it called? Writing to the government those letters,
petitions,
complaints. They're writing those complaints, and sometimes it works. We also wrote a big complaint to the EU government, so they see how their money are being spent in our country, and that scares them. So they pretty much stop doing them now. But at some point, there were plans to build, I think, about 800 of them, mini dams. This is basically every little stream.
Wow.
And but they haven't built them all, and some of them because they skip some of the rules, or they don't do something properly, and they expect nobody to notice that. But of course there are people that we are watching them.
Yeah. That's really cool to hear, and really interesting that anglers are having an impact on government decisions as well. So it's heartwarming to hear that, and it's brilliant to learn about that as well. And you mentioned a fishing club, and that sort of leads in nicely to the culture of fishing in Bulgaria. Is it a big participation pastime? Are there lots of clubs, or are there a lot of people fishing? Is there a network of people?
Well, there is. There is plenty of fishing clubs, and about 7 or 8 fly fishing clubs. And we also joined in a federation now of fly fishermen. And we really try to not just criticize the government, but also to help them. And this has been of great use for the last, let's say, decade, because many things have changed for good as well. For example, since I think it's been 4 or 5 years now that we have here in Bulgaria only catch and release areas, only catch and release rivers for brown trout. Every brown trout should be released back in the water, and it's about 20 rivers. And this is really effective now, I think, because honestly, I think there is more fish now before, if we compare it 10 years ago or even 6, 7 years ago. So this is one thing now, and those clubs we organize every year do some cleanups of the rivers, do some school for kids, try to educate them, and try to take care of the rivers, because this is relatively new thing here in Bulgaria. All rivers belongs to the government, to the country, the national treasure. There's no private. You cannot own a stretch of river privately here. So this is on one side it's okay, but they don't really take care of it properly. So then we have to take care of it and show them that the local community, the local people especially, want to take care. And there are good examples now. There are a few rivers that these things really works, and the local people are taking great care of those rivers.
That's wonderful to hear, and it's fantastic to hear that you're encouraging youngsters in. The age group generally is perceived in the UK as older. Is it a similar sort of case there, or is it more like Scandinavia where the fishing community is that much younger?
There is quite a lot of enthusiastic young people in the sport now, but they're more interested in the competition part of it. They like to join a competition, or they like to compete. And I think it's good they're interested in fly fishing, but what I'm trying to always teach them and learn them is to do it, to learn first to properly fly fish, which is done with a rod and line, casting the line. And then maybe if they want to learn these modern techniques, Czech, French, Spanish nymphing, it's all right. But fly fishing for me is fly casting first.
I think I'm with you, and I know we touched on that, and it's not a snobbery thing. I'll nymph when I need to nymph. But
the nymph can be done with a fly line too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, coming from a sporting background, I think for me that the casting ties in with the sport part of it as well. You know, that sort of application. I like to, where I can, make a nice cast and get a drag-free drift and everything else. Yep. And I think that's probably one of the reasons I've been thinking since I've been doing these podcasts, because I ask the question a lot. And I've been thinking about it a lot as well and thinking, right, okay, why is it that I like casting a fly line as opposed to, and I'll fish whatever's appropriate. I'll pull a streamer, I do whatever it is, and that's the fishing guide in me that will do that. But I do get a sense, a pleasure out of a nice cast and a drag-free drift and that. Is it a similar sort of thing for you? It sounds like
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, absolutely. If I fish on my own now, I really pretty much only fish one fly and fish it with a fly line. Nymph, dry, streamer, it all can be fished. And that's the thing. That's the most interesting part of it. You can fish it and it needs more control and line handling and all those things. It's not always easy, but if you want to learn to do it, you have to do it. You can't just say, ah, this is a bit too complicated. It's easier to just turn around those nymphs. I'm not saying it's easy to French nymph. There are techniques there as well, a lot of them. But fly fishing for me is defined by fly casting. Mm.
And that's really interesting to hear from somebody, because you have competed and done really well in competitions as well, haven't you?
I've done awful lot of modern nymphing, a lot of it. But I think now I'm getting back to the classics, more just the real fly fishing, because I'm a bit off of the competitions now. I used to organize them, but last year I think I organized them for, let's say, one last year now, and decided that I have to concentrate much more on my guiding and tuition, and I've done a fair amount of competitions. Not that I'm going to completely stop doing them, but for now I'm giving them a little bit of rest and concentrating on organizing trips and guiding and coaching.
Cool. And we're going to come on to the guiding shortly. It's interesting, a question I'll throw at you about that and easing back from the competition thing, because I guess I've not done it. So, you know, I'm interested to hear how people approach these things. And do you think you're stepping away from it comes as you get a little bit older as well, and the need to compete isn't always necessarily as strong as it is when you are younger, perhaps?
That is certainly one thing. Definitely, I agree with that. But I also think it's really hard for me. I've had a hard time trying to organize a Bulgarian team, a whole team, to find sponsors for this. And it's a lot of effort. that doesn't really go in the, I think, the right direction, because it's a lot of effort and it still might not succeed for us here. Maybe if in another country it's much easier, but from what I've spoke with other anglers from all over the world, it's never easy to get in the team and to organize a good team. But I think for us in Bulgaria here, it's even harder at some point. And I've seen some things that I don't like in competition. People are always counting fish and they are only interested in catching more and more and more. And they don't really care about how they catch them. And I start not to really like those things. Like I meet someone, competitive angler on the river, and he says, it's not a really good day. I only caught 25 fish. For me, even 12 fish is... It's always great to be out on the river and you have to enjoy every fish. That's what I mean.
Yeah. And I guess if you are looking to accrue numbers, I'm sure anglers still appreciate every one of those trout. But, you know, I'm a pleasure angler through and through now. And I make sure every single fish, because they're all beautiful, even if they're small, every one of them is absolutely stunning, aren't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Fish are all beautiful, and the way to catch them is also beautiful when you do it the way you want it to. So
yes.
I really enjoy it.
Yeah. So let's come on. You've talked about the guiding and the tuition, and how did that come about? How did you decide you wanted to be a fishing guide in Bulgaria? And I guess you're probably... one of the very few, if only, I guess.
Well, there are a few of us. There is one old guy that used to do some proper guiding. He's the oldest fly fisherman I know around here. He's in his 80s now, and he fished most of his life. So we were all learning from him. He's the Bulgarian fishing legend. of course. And, well... I think I just wanted to spend some time on the water and to be out more and more. But this is wrong. I think if somebody wants to become a guide, he has to know now, definitely, that to become a guide doesn't mean for you just to be out on the water. It means that you need to help somebody. And I realized this with the time, and I'm happy to enjoy now being out there, but also helping those people to catch, to learn a proper way of fishing, a technique, or show them how a fly is tied. And when you do it properly, then you really start to enjoy.
And so what sort of format do your days take? They're guiding days. Do you sort of, is it mostly guided days or is it
tuition? It's mostly guided days, although I now organize those courses or seminars. And last year we did one or two, and it was fully booked. People signed up, 8 persons, because for more than 8, it's really complicated. And it's mainly guided days or a few days or a trip, hosted trip. Well, if it's just a day or two, I don't have a fixed time as a guide. I don't like this. I've seen we start at 9 and go back till 5, and the fish actually takes from 6 to 9 in the afternoon. So I'm happy to agree with the clients, and I don't have any problems going very early, getting back very late. And we go to the river, but it's also... it's not just to catch the fish. I want them to learn them a specific technique that day. If we are planning to mainly fish dry fly or if we are planning to fish nymphs, I want to show the person how this technique is done. And then if he learns the technique, he can catch fish anywhere with his technique. Yeah. So I focus more like... tuition and coaching than just to point a fish and say, there is a fish.
Yeah, cast over there.
Cast over there.
Yeah. And so are you getting anglers from Bulgaria, or are you getting people from across Europe and beyond?
It's mainly people across from pretty much all over the world. It's strange, but it's true. Because the Bulgarians, they know everything about fishing, women, and football. So it's hard to teach them. But of course, I have some good clients from Bulgaria as well. There are people here who also know that it's that will save a lot of time if they just take a guide for a day or two, and they will learn a lot from his experience. And but it's mainly people from outside, people from all over, people from UK, people from Italy, from Europe, but also people. Last year I had Mark Klasper all the way from New Zealand.
Wow.
He came on its trip in Europe. We went in Bosnia and Croatia to fish for some grayling, because grayling was what he was after, as they don't have it there. So, yeah, people are coming from all over.
Yeah, and do you, obviously having a lot of streams around, do you sort of have in mind where you're going to take people with conditions, and you have a vast amount of water, I guess, you can show people as well, including chalk streams, which is a great selling point for you, isn't it?
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't quite get it, the question.
I was saying that you have a lot of streams in your neck of the woods, in your part, that you can take people to, including chalk streams. And so it's a really nice mixture of a day or 2 days you can show people.
I think it can be done for weeks, not just for days.
Yeah.
Because we're not just in Bulgaria. I guide on all the Balkan countries, mainly Bosnia, Serbia, Bulgaria, and Slovenia, let's say. I also did some decent amount of guiding in Montenegro. But the fishing tourism is really developed, as you know, in Slovenia, in Bosnia. Everybody advertises those places. And it's nice there. It's beautiful. Those rivers, they're just amazing. But what happens there is... what I see is that we are on the queue there. There is a lot of people going fishing there all the time. All the companies make trips there. And it's something that I don't really like that much. I try to find another place. I try to find a small river. And this is, when it comes to Bulgaria, it's an advantage. Usually it's not overcrowded here on most places. And... for me, sometimes it's worth it being the only person on the river, even if you're catching slightly smaller fish, than just queuing to catch the next rainbow fish.
And that's a really great selling point as well, isn't it? And would it be fair to describe, relatively speaking, Bulgaria as still undiscovered as such? I know obviously you're guiding people and stuff like that, but do you think it would be fair to say, you know, a lot of people haven't really discovered what Bulgaria has to offer?
They haven't really discovered Bulgaria, and I will be honest here, and I think maybe Bulgaria, yeah, it's undiscovered, but there is even more undiscovered country for fly fishing, and it's Greece.
Right.
Greece is a really interesting country, because fly fishing is definitely not popular there, although it might have started there hundreds of years ago. But Greece have some beautiful rivers, and I'm visiting one that's about 5 hours drive from Sofia, and me and Charles Jardin went there 2 years ago. I invited him to come around, and he came, and we spent some great week out there catching some nice rainbow and more rainbows there, and brown trout. But there's also plenty of other rivers in Greece, which I'm about to explore this year. It's on my list to go further south in Greece, and I know there are more rivers there, and I heard there are some nice fish, and there it's really wild.
Wow.
And fish are wild too. It's brown trout mainly, apart from this tailwater we've been to with the rainbows. So, it's unexplored here. It's not, it has its advantages, but also disadvantages, because as I said, there is no clubs and organizations that take care of certain stretch of the river. So you buy a week or year ticket to fish, and it's usually not expensive at all, or you don't even need it. Like in Greece, you don't need a permission to fish fresh water. And that can be good, but it also has its bad things, because then everybody learns that there are fish there and they can be caught, and then more people start to go there. So
yeah. I remember when you first started discovering and you sent me an image.
Oh.
And you said, don't say where it comes from. And
this was then. That's what happens.
Yeah.
With that river. I fish it now for, I think, 7 years. Mm. And when we first discovered it, it was like 4 or 5 of us going there.
Mm.
And for days, you don't meet anyone on the river. And if you meet someone, it's... it doesn't know really how to fish. He's a local guy.
Mm.
And we were catching some massive, massive rainbow trout. Somebody stocked those fish there, probably when they were building the dam. Some Austrian company built the dam and they stocked those rainbows. And I think they might even reproduce there, because there are every year, they're all kind of sizes, all fish, and they look really fresh. They look perfect. And they grow big as a rainbow can grow. And we were catching, like we have days before that you were catching 4 or 5 fish over 60 centimeters, which is, what is it, in inches? I'm not sure.
I'm useless at that, but it sounds big.
Yeah, it's over 20-something inches, 25, yeah. Over 25. Yeah, big fish, 4 pounds, yeah, 7 pounds, 8 pounds.
Yeah, well, I remember that photo that you sent me, and I can say that I was true to my promise. I never told a soul where it was. So I don't know if we've let the cat out of the bag a little bit.
I've guided a few groups now from UK, from Germany, from Holland there. And it's not that easy recently, but... fish are out there. I know where they fish. They're 20 kilometers of river. And last till end of October there, we were there with a group of German guys. They were just coming back from Czech Republic, catching easy fish, Czech nymphing. And I said to them, okay. They said, we expect to catch about 20 fish a day. I said, okay, that might not happen here, but I will teach you how to properly fly fish, and you will catch some decent fish. And they all caught fish over 4 pounds.
Wow.
For these 5 days. So they were really happy. They said, we learn a lot at the end.
That's fantastic, isn't it? And all these things, one of the questions that's just come into my head while you mentioned that, because I was thinking of Greece, I was thinking of the mountain ranges. And is it similar in Bulgaria? Do you get runoff from the snow?
Yeah, it's the same mountain. It's just the Greek part. It's the Rodopi mountain. So it's part of it. The bigger part of it is in Bulgaria, and the other part is in Greece. And yeah, it's mainly snow-fed rivers. So the good season is now, April, May, June. Then we have some problems in the summer with low water levels and dry. Last year was really dry.
Mm.
And but then we can fish the tail waters. It's become popular now. Quite a lot of trout in those tail waters. We mainly have smaller rivers here in Bulgaria. We don't have those big rivers, big trout rivers. We have smaller rivers and streams. But fishing a 3-4 weight rod from 7 to 9 feet, it's just perfect.
That sounds my idea of heaven, I have to say. I'm almost, if it were possible right now, I think I'd be booking a ticket while we were talking. It just sounds for not all of it as well. And to see Bulgaria would be fantastic. And you said you head into the Balkans and there's some fun and interesting fishing over those neck of the woods as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would say the Balkans are a mecca for fly fishing. Okay, let's leave Bulgaria on the side, but Slovenia, Bosnia, these are just paradise. They have a lot of river, and it becomes really popular there, but there's still those hidden places. It's a lot of rivers, and big rivers, and a lot of fish to be caught, brown trout and grayling, some big grayling there, over 2 pounds on places. I know most of those places are popular now, like the Ribnik River in Bosnia, but it wasn't that popular 10, 12 years ago. So they gave a good example how sustainable fishing tourism can be done. And I still use it, for example, trying to convince people here that it can be done the same. It can be the same in Bulgaria.
Well, fingers crossed that works for you. And it just sounds the variety of fishing that, relatively speaking, is pretty close to your doorstep, or you can move between.
The nearest trout stream is about, the nearest one is probably 10 minutes with a car, and there's another one further out which is probably 20-25 minutes driving, and these are tailwaters below dams near Sofia, and we can fish them below the dams, and there's also trout above the dams where the river flows free, and it's good amount of brown trout there, and especially on this one that is 25 minutes drive from my home. I call it my locals, my home stream. There's a good mayfly hatch there. So I love to fish there in May and June when the big Danicas are hatching. And I'm just thinking people are paying a lot of money to go fishing when the Danicas are hatching somewhere in UK. And I have it just here, half an hour away.
Yeah, it's just, I have the same here too. And I was talking to somebody the other day about it and saying, you know, we have a hatch that the fish get locked onto, but it's not your fly when you cast it out isn't going to be lost in a cast of thousands. So there's a pretty good chance you're going to get whacked by a trout. And it is, there are so many little places that are cheaper, affordable throughout the UK and Europe. From what you've just been saying as well.
Oh, yes.
A day on a big name piece of water in Mayfly, you could actually head elsewhere.
A week somewhere else. Yeah.
Which is fascinating. But you alluded to earlier that you went to the UK to study, although you really wanted to study fishing. How do you see I guess on that basis, you've done a lot of fishing in the UK. Do you have a fondness for the fishing over here?
Yeah, I did a fair amount of fishing in the UK, and I love it. I learn a lot. I learn a lot about the reservoirs first, because I was really into competitive fly fishing at that time. So the part I was not that good at, so I thought I have to learn more and more and more. And I started fishing those reservoirs, Grafham Waters, Rutland, and I did some fishing there, but it's not exactly my type of fishing. I'm a river fisherman, so I then searched for trout streams, and I was based in Cambridge. So that not that many around there, but I went to the choke streams. I went to the test, to the Itchen a few times, and it's great there. It's just perfect. I love it. I'd love to go there again and fish the test again. It's been a while since my last time, And then I discover Scotland. And this was just probably one of the best places I've ever fished and some of the greatest moments, fishing moments in my life. I fished this river Annan, the Clyde, the Nith. I also fished during the World Championship in 2009 in Scotland. It was more lochs than lakes, rivers, but we also fished some rivers. And it's amazing there. The wildlife, the fish, they're really strong, they're beautiful. And there's some big fish out there.
Well, yeah, I fished some of those ones early season particularly. I've been up there. And while you're in Scotland, did you swing flies for salmon as well?
Not to be honest. I tried to fish for sea trout there because it's funny. I was on the Annan and I was fishing there during the day on my own for trout and grayling, caught some nice fish, and it was getting dark. And I thought, okay, it's time. I call it a day. So I start to pack everything. And then these guys just came and they start to set up their rods. They say, what are you doing? I said, I'm over for today. I caught some nice fish. They say, but no, fishing is just starting now.
Yeah.
And they meant, of course, sea trout fishing at night. So they told me about it and I was excited. And I tried, caught one or two fish. And I think it's something really, really exciting to do fishing at night for sea trout. I'd love to do it again, to try again. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're fascinating, enigmatic fish, and I actually prefer to try and catch them during the day because it's seen as a nighttime pursuit. So, and particularly as we come back to the Danicas as well, you know, when the mayfly are about, they'll rise, whether they're eating or whether it's a habit, they'll rise and we catch sea trout on dry flies. And I remember guiding someone once and I knew where sea trout would sit. And I think a lot of it is knowing whether they're there or not. And I knew it would be a hot spot for where a sea trout would be. And we tied on I think it was can't remember what the fly was now, French partridge, I think now. Mm-hmm. And he cast and a huge great head came up, ate the fly, and then leapt around and leapt out of the water. And we saw him and he was a good 8 or 9 pound. It was a really, really big fresh sea trout, which
can get better.
Pinged the leader eventually, and then a little bit later in the day we went to another beat and he caught one, a smaller one, about pound and a half on a mayfly pattern as well. So I kind of like that and I find it really good fun as well.
Definitely. And you said salmon. I didn't have my chances to try for salmon in Scotland, but I went to Norway for the European Fly Fishing Championship in, I think it was 2008, or long ago. And then I tried to fish for salmon one day and I hooked that fish. I was lucky on my first salmon fishing ever to hook a fish on the first time. And I lost the fish. Oh. And then it took me years before I really caught my first salmon. But it happened in UK. I have a good friend living on the South Tyne, and we are visiting him every year. And we are now organizing this trip there on the South Tyne. It's the Lambley Beat. It's Lambley Cottages. We stay there and we fish the South Tyne, and it's beautiful. It's been 7 years now that we go there, and we catch fish, we catch salmon there. And I'm into salmon fishing. Just do my part of it 1 week in the year there, but maybe I'll go somewhere else soon or late.
Well, the Tyne, I guess, is a really good place to start as well, and to find fish. And you know, it is, I found over the last 10 or so years, it's quite addictive, and trout will always be my first love. But man, I love salmon, and the hours that you put in just for that, when that line comes to life, is fantastic. And I'm prepared to invest all that time for that one moment, I think.
I would say it's my type of fishing. I'm happy to fish all day for one take, if it's worth it for a big fish. And but the salmon, it doesn't really feed in the water. So we focus recently on the Danube salmon, which is the mighty Hutchen. And during the winter time, I've been fishing for it now 5 years. It took me some hard time to learn the hard way, but then I found some good mentors. And this year, season 2019-2020, was a great success. We caught some nice Hutchen over a meter. I organized a group and we went to Slovenia. We fished Slovenia and Bosnia for this fish. It's the biggest salmon. It, as you probably know, it can get up to 30 kilos over meter 20. It's some serious fish, but it takes its time and a lot of hard work. And it's rough conditions in the winter time. It's cold.
And how are you catching these fish, Stan? Will it be, what is the way? Are you swinging flies? How are you swinging? Are you swinging them? Or are you moving them? Or how are you fishing?
It's one of the tricks. You don't really need to move the fly. You just have to let it swing gently across the current. And when it's out to feed the Hutchen, it will just smash that fly. It will eat it.
Yeah.
And you will definitely feel the take. And then you have to strip strike it, which you better prepare for, because you might lose the fish of your trip otherwise. So
doing a trout strike, I guess.
Doing a trout strike. It's easy to say, you have to strip strike. You don't have to lift the rod. But it's really hard to do it when you have to do it. I even thought of tying my hand to the belt.
I guess when you're spending many hours chasing these fish, you don't know when it's going to happen. And I know exactly what you mean about strip striking. You know, when I bone fish, if I'm up front or if we're on a boat particularly, when I cast at a fish, my mantra the whole time, I'm saying in my head, don't strike. Don't strike. But I guess if you're going hours and hours and hours without a fish, that's a hard one to stick to, isn't it?
I'm saying to myself all the time, don't strike. But then when you feel the take, the adrenaline rush is so big that, of course, first time you will strike. You know you're doing it properly when you start strip striking to the bottom or a rock or something. Yeah. Then you know you're finally doing it properly.
And for our listeners, Stan, can you tell us a little bit about Hutchen? Because I guess we don't have them here. And if people haven't heard of them, or how would you describe them? And what sort of sizes do these things get to? I guess they eat other fish, but what sort of sizes do they get to?
Total top predators, top of the food chain in the river. And they inhabit all the Danube tributaries, upper parts of the Danube tributaries. And it's a bucket list fish, I think. It's not the greatest fighter ever. Probably like a salmon that's been in the river for a while. But they can be very strong because they get big. And it's, as I said, streamer fishing, some big streamers, let's say 6-7 inch streamers, 10 over 10 weight rods, 10-12 weight is a good rod. Some people use double handers. It's effective because there are places where it's hard to overhead cast the fly. And if you have the right line, it's a bit hard to turn over a heavy streamer with the double hander. But it's effective. And as I said, it's hard work. You have to know where those fish are, and then you have to search for them. And a good guide can really save you maybe a lot of time. And when they're out to feed, then they're active and you have bigger chance. But this doesn't happen often. This can happen like once in 10 days they are out. They don't feed very often. They just go out, eat a grayling or some white fish, and then they just lay down. And usually, the average size, it depends on the river, but a decent huchen is considered to be over a meter, I think, because these 60, 70, 80 centimeter fish, they're good, but a proper one is a meter long one. And this year, I caught my first meter huchen.
Well done. Many congratulations.
A few of them. So, yeah. So I think I know what I'm doing now, and I'm having the confidence now. And I'm looking forward for next season, and I really hope it will be all fine then, and we'll be catching them in Bosnia and Slovenia.
Fantastic. And it's really interesting you talk about those, because in the current spring issue of Fly Culture, we have Peter Morse, and he's gone to Mongolia to catch taimen. Are they similar to Hucha?
I guess they really are, because it's their relatives. Yeah. And I never fished for the taimen so far, but it's next on the list, really. And they are similar. From what I've read and heard, the taimen is, it goes for the streamers to it attacks on the surface. It can be caught on a, not a dry fly, but a imitation of a dry mammal on the surface. And the huchen, it's really hard to make him right. It can happen, but it's really, really hard. But I guess it's pretty much the same. I find it all similar with these fishing big streamers with 10 to 12 weight rods. When someone learns to cast those big streamers and to strip strike, this I find really important, then you can catch a lot of different big fish, some big predators out there, isn't it? It's the huchen. You can fish with big streamers. I see those guys fishing the Dorado, the saltwater fishing. It's pretty much casting streamers and strip striking the fish. Bike fishing too. It's not that different. It's just that in pike fishing you just strip slow.
And I remember a video you sent me that, again, we put in Eat Sleep Fish of you on a pike fishing trip. But before we go there, I just wanted to ask you about Russia and if you fished over in that part of the world, because it's something I know virtually zero about. And that must be an untapped resource as well when it comes to fishing.
It definitely is. That was our plans with some friends here for this autumn. But we will see. I haven't fished Russia, haven't been there yet. But there is some of the best parts, especially when we talk about taimen. It's Siberia. And we were looking at this island of above Japan, what it was called, Sakhalin Island. And there is this endemic taimen there, which is a really beautiful fish. It's the most beautiful taimen of all, I think. So hopefully it will happen that we go there and try to catch one. And it's untouched there. It's just, I don't know, those places.
And those places, the untouched and unexplored, undiscovered, they're the things it sounds like really are of great interest to you.
They are. That's what I'm after. And here in Europe, it's hard to find such a place, untouched place. I really believe Greece was one of those untouched places where you can go and meet no one on the river. Well, of course, the Scandinavian countries are quite untouched. But we went there 2 years ago in Lapland with a friend of mine, and we even flew with a helicopter to this Tjørnøyok fishing camp, and I was surprised. It's so many anglers out there, and some of the fish have the the lips torn apart a little bit. So there is fishing pressure even on those places there. So it's really, really hard to find untouched places now.
Mm. And it sounds as though you are a salmon angler in the making, really, with the species you're preferring to chase as well.
Maybe, yes. Maybe I'd prefer sometimes to really put some effort for one fish, just to catch one fish.
Yeah. Well, those hucho sound amazing and really super interesting. But let's move on to pike then, because I know you do a fair bit of pike fishing. Where do you do your pike fishing?
Well, I started doing it in the UK on the River Cam. That's where I started fly fishing for pike. And I realized soon that my streamers were way too small. So I have to grow bigger, make them bigger and bigger. And I don't know, it can be really big, the streamer for pike. But it's not always necessary. And then when I moved back to Bulgaria, I fished some pike here. We do have pike, not that many, but we do have pike. Some really good pike fishing I did in Serbia. There was this natural reserve there, this lake that was not allowed for fishing, but then they open it. And there was some huge pike and plenty of them. So we started going there on this lake Joca, and we were catching a lot of pike. And big ones as well. And that's where I've done some good amount of fishing for pike. But the last few years, I haven't done that much of it.
But was that the lake that was in the video that
yeah,
we
had? That's the one.
Yeah, that looked phenomenal. The whole trip, the friends and the company you had and everything just looked an amazing...
It was perfect. It was perfect. And it doesn't cost anything at all there because it's pretty cheap, everything there, especially in this part of Serbia. But now a lot of people know about it. And there is some good fishing there for pike, but it's popular now. Before, when it was just opened, oh, it was amazing. But it's a beautiful scenery, a lot of birds, a lot of wildlife. We've seen once we were there fishing and we heard that noise and it sounded like wild boars. And we looked and there were these family of boars crossing, swimming through the lake to the island. There is an island, so they were swimming right in front of us. I found it spectacular.
Wow, that does sound absolutely fantastic. Now, talking of animals, I know you have a beagle, and I've seen him again. He was in one of our articles. Do you take him fishing? Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, I have my beagle, Thirsty. It's Thirsty because he was the first one to be born from his family.
Yeah.
And I used to take him fishing more and more, but not that much now because beagles, I'm telling this to everyone, don't take beagle if you think it's not a good fishing dog. It's not a good fishing dog at all. It follows its sense of smell. It smells something and it just follows it. And it's really hard to... It can be really hard with the beagle, but I have a lot of funny stories that the beagle escape and then I have to try to find it. It's not funny, but at the moment, it wasn't really. So I stopped taking him with me when I'm with groups or guiding, but when I'm on my own, I still take him around. He needs attention. If I look at him more often, then he sticks around. But if I concentrate too much on my fishing, then he just might disappear again. And then
yeah,
he will come back. But it might take a whole day.
Yeah, but they're good company, aren't they?
They are good company. They're lovely dogs. Just that they're hunting dogs. They're not fishing
dogs. That's fantastic to hear. And I hope he joins you on many more adventures as well. Yeah. Is there, you've touched on some places. What is, if money were no object, where is the one place you would love to go and fish?
If money were no object, yeah. Well, I might be a bit of a cliche, but I'm now interested in saltwater fishing since I have a little touch of it when we went with my wife as a honeymoon 2 years ago to the Seychelles,
wow,
the main islands, and I did some saltwater fishing there, as much as I can afford to do on a honeymoon mornings. And I caught some fish, couldn't manage to catch a bonefish, but I caught some fish, and we went out on a guided day out with a boat one day. So we caught some green job fish, and I lost this bluefin trevally.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing. So I think I would go somewhere to catch some saltwater fish. I don't really need to catch the biggest of them. Just it will be saltwater destinations. I don't know. Probably the Seychelles again, just the Otter Island.
It's funny, I was going to ask you whether you caught bluefin trevally, because I caught some down in the Maldives, and I remember writing a piece about the trip and saying that bonefish go along the flats like Nijinsky, the ballet dancer, whereas bluefin are just like Mike Tyson, and they are just fantastic. I've not caught giant trevally, but if they're a taster of what the giant trevally are like, just phenomenal fish.
We were on the boat that day. I hooked it from the boat. I just lost it. We were close to have him on the boat, but the hook just went off. And the guide, he was popping with his popper for the giant trevally. He said, first of all, this attracts some fish, as you know, to the fly as well. This way he was kind of helping me, but he said, I want to hook one just to see the power of this fish. And he had that take. I saw that take. This GT just smashed the popper, and it was a big one, and he broke his line because he struck it really strong, but then it went and he broke the line. And I thought, wow, that's a fish I'd like to catch, but maybe I really need to get fitter a bit. Go to the gym.
And bonefish are, you know, just phenomenal. And you always remember your first one of those, and they'll be exciting. And I hope that does.
Maldives are a good place to do it, to catch them. A friend of mine went there and they caught some. I think it's on the list.
Yeah, phenomenal fish. They're all fantastic. That's the great thing about fly fishing, isn't it? The species, the experiences, the things that we can do that makes it constantly evolving. And it never, certainly to me, and it sounds like to you, never is boring in any way, shape or form. That's a great thing.
Never. It's never boring. For me, the essence of fly fishing is trout on a small stream with a dry fly, sight fishing if possible. But this is just, if I have one day to fish, I will go back to fish the dry on a small stream. But otherwise, I'd like to explore the whole world and go everywhere and catch all those fish. Not just the one they are showing us from the big companies. And there are many fish that we really don't know about, and they can still be caught on a fly. I'm sure about this.
Yeah. So let's take this in. We're going to start winding things down. We've spoken for well over an hour now.
Oh, right.
But what about tackle and stuff? Do you have a Hall of Fame rod? Is there one that you'd never part with, the one that's done everything for you, the one that means a lot? Do you have a Hall of Fame rod?
Yeah, this changes slightly. So with me getting older, I guess. If it's, let's divide it like this. If it's modern nymphing technique, Czech nymphing, French nymphing, I have this GMC, old GMC Elite series fly rod, which I caught a lot of fish with. And if it's this type of fishing, I'd love to use it. But recently, I received a glass rod as a gift some 4 years ago from a guy, French guy that I guided, really nice guy, and I fall in love with this rod. It's a Kabuto Japanese rod builder, fiberglass, 7 feet, 3 weight. And I'm basically fishing it at the moment, almost in every small stream and every little river. It's suitable for fish up to a pound, let's say, not much bigger than this, because it's just 3 weight, 7 feet. I've caught bigger fish with it, but I don't think it's the right tackle for those fish. And I love it. It's really nice. It's just to enjoy the casting and the fight with the fish. And it allows you to do some really short but precise casts because the rod loads itself just really, really easy. And this is one of my favorite. And I have another one that's this Hardy Zenit Sintrix 8.6 4 weight. It's my all-round rod that I carbon fiber that I use almost everywhere to catch trout, grayling, everything. It's really nice rod. These series I think are great. Really light, really great rods.
Fantastic. It's really interesting to see. And through a lot of these conversations I've had, and I know the one with Paul Proctor, the one with Nick Hart, we talked about rods, and you hit a really interesting point where you said, as I get a little bit older, and, you know, I'm sure when you were taking your casting qualifications, it was a stiff rod that you were really into.
Exactly.
And now, as I get older, it's something with a little bit more feel in, and I want something that will play those fish as well. And I find a slightly deeper loading rod now is where I'm sort of aiming towards, really.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you on this, because that's what I recommend. Everybody have to put his hand on a glass rod just to try, just to see. And my glass rod is fast action glass rod. That's because some of them are really, really slow and I don't really like them. But this one is great. And with things change with age, I guess we end up fishing cane.
Yeah, I do. And I do regularly on small streams generally. There's a friend of mine, Luke Bannister, who again I podcasted with, and he makes them and they're just awesome. He makes a faster action, he calls it the super fast. I have one of those, and then he has a, I think it's a Leonard 7 foot 3 weight, and for throwing dry flies on a small stream is just perfect.
That's that's it. 3 weight, seven feet 3 weight.
Yeah,
it's just perfect.
Yeah. They're great fun. Stan, this has been fantastic learning about somewhere that I know so little about, yet seems to offer so much. Man, I'm when we get sorted out, we need to talk when we're off mic, because I'd love to come and see you and fish.
You're always
you.
Welcome.
It seems phenomenal. How, if people wanted to visit Bulgaria and fish with you, how do they get hold of you?
Not just Bulgaria, but the whole Balkan Peninsula. Anywhere around here, if I'm not available, I can at least help with advice and send them to the right guides. They can get in touch with me on my details on my website, my contacts. It's mankoflyfishing.com. And I'm working now on a newer version of it, which should be done very, very soon. Now I have a lot of time at home, so I'm concentrated there. It will be much better with a lot of descriptions on rivers and trips and so on. So it's my website, mankoflyfishing.com.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put those in the show notes as well. It's been lovely to catch up with you. It's been lovely to speak with you. So, Stan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you very much, too. It was a pleasure for me, and I hope for everyone to enjoy our podcast.
I'm sure they will. So thank you, everyone. This has been the Fly Culture Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the podcast and the stories that are coming out. During the lockdown, you'll see that I've been trying to release them regularly so that you've got something to listen to. And I hope in some small way they do help. So please keep listening. If there's any questions you'd like, if you'd like to get in touch with Stan and can't find anything, just drop me a line. If you feel there's somebody I should be interviewing, I've got a long list of people and I've got a catalogue of interviews to release. But if there's someone you feel I should be talking to, let me know. But in the meantime, I just hope you continue to enjoy the Fly Culture podcast. This has been Pete Tigis. Thanks for listening.
The Fly Culture podcast is brought to you in association with Fly Culture, a quarterly print magazine. For more information, please visit flyculturemag.com. You can also find Fly Culture on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.